So would you like to have your Bibles open at the book of Ecclesiastes? I'm going to read it this morning in the NIV, and then I'm going to read it in the New English Translation also, just 8 verses. So here it is in the NIV. The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What do people gain from all their labours at which they toil under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. And here is the New English Translation, which I'm very fond of. And you'll notice some slight changes, but I think they're very useful for you to hear them. Futile. Futile, laments the teacher. Absolutely futile. Everything is futile. What benefit do people get from all the effort which they expend on earth? A generation comes and a generation goes, but the earth remains the same through the ages. The sun rises and the sun sets. It hurries away to a place from which it rises again. The wind goes to the south and circles round to the north. Round and round the wind goes, and on its rounds it returns. All the streams flow into the sea, but the sea is not full. And to the place where the streams flow, there they will flow again. All this monotony is tiresome. No one can bear to describe it. The eye is never satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear ever content with hearing. Well, I hope that reading it like that in another version is very helpful to you. I'm sure it will be. Well, last week we made our first tentative steps into the book of Ecclesiastes. And I said at the beginning last week that it would be good if we had some kind of rules of engagement that we could stick with. So I would remind you what those rules of engagement would be. I said last week that the writer is in no rush to talk to us about God. That is perfectly obvious. And in fact, when he does talk to us about God, it's not the Lord he's speaking about, it's the God almost in a distant way, even then. But later on, as we discover God, then we discover the true and living God. But what he wants us to do is he wants us to look at the world that we can all see, and he wants us to ask the question, as he asked, does it have the answers that it purports to have? Does the world have all the answers that it seems to give? He looks at things under the sun, and he repeats this word, under the sun. It's as if his place, if you like, his starting point is ground zero. It's at earth's level. It's from the point of those things that can be observed. And it's like this, that he stands in the shoes of the humanist. He stands in the shoes of the secularist. And you live in a world of humanism. You live in a secularist world. Someone said to me last week, what is a humanist? Well, a humanist is only this, someone whose interests are purely human and do not go beyond being human. Where are all your interests? Where are all your interests? A if they're purely human and in this world, you can quite rightly describe yourself as a humanist. If you're a secularist, then you would say the only thing that matters is this world. Why bother thinking about a world beyond this world? Don't waste your time. That's what the secularist says. So what he does, the philosopher, the teacher, the preacher, what do we call him? Translated, Koheleth. Koheleth says, I'll stand in the shoes of the secularist. I'll stand in the shoes of the humanist. And I'll tell you what we'll do. I'll put under the microscope all the ideas of the thinking of the secularist and the humanist. And let's have a look at them. Think of yourself this morning. You might be a humanist. Have you ever put your ideas under the microscope? Have you ever really looked at them? Have you ever thought that they really work? Here is a man, here is a teacher, here is the philosopher, here is the thinker. And he says, let's go and explore the world and its thinking. And let's see really where all of its paths lead to. And I'm sure that you would agree with me as we go about this journey with him. You would say that God couldn't be fairer. God couldn't be fairer to include in his word a book like this. He says, I'll have one of my inspired writers to stand in the shoes of the people whose vast way of thinking is the opposite to believing in me. And let's analyse just what they think. Let's see where it takes them. Let's see where their ideas and their philosophy actually goes to. Now, God couldn't be fairer. You wouldn't find this in any other work. You wouldn't. In any other work that was written by man, you would never find this. And so I think that it would be good, especially for the young people, to be willing this morning to let God speak to you and reason with you through his word. Somebody will say, I don't need God's purpose in my life. And I don't need his paths, thank you very much. I don't need to walk in God's ways. So the philosopher says, okay, I'm prepared to look at the alternative, the one that you are going for. And I'll put it under the spotlight and see if it's really that attractive. What a wonderful book the book of Ecclesiastes is. So at the very beginning, the author says everything is meaningless or futile. Not just futile, but as I said last week, utterly futile. And it's not just on the surface of things that it's futile. No, it's the sum total. He says everything. He says everything smells of vanity. And it might be that someone here this morning says, well, everything doesn't smell of vanity to me. It smells all right. Okay. Let's put it to the test. And let's take the joy of having a child. We've got lots of children here. Wonderful. The joy of children. Wonderful. Make us so happy to have them, and so many of them. And yet just outside the back door, 10 yards from here, there's a gravestone, which I stood and looked at with my wife the other day. And there is the death of the mother recorded, and the death of a child 1 year and 3 months, and then the death of the next child 1 year and 5 months. And I ask you, where do you derive meaning from that? Where's the meaning in that? Tell me. Those of you who are humanists this morning, who see no place for the divine, give me some meaning for that. How do you look into the face of that mother in 1907 and say, I've got some meaning for you? In a meaningless world, what can the world offer? What answer can it give? I'm begging for answers. And of course, this is the reality of the world that we live in. This isn't make-believe. Everyone is begging for answers in a meaninglessness world in which they live. His scrutiny, you see in the text, is everything. Not some things, but everything. And the only conclusion he can come to is meaningless, because he uses the word 35 times in this short book. Meaningless, meaningless, meaningless. It's a groping for meaning. And if we'd have met that mother in 1907, she would have said, "I'm groping for meaning." Of course she would. Of course she would. Yesterday, to take it to a lighter note, but still profound, I went outside and I saw Henneke sweeping the blossom. We've got a beautiful blossom tree. And people were coming past our drive the other day and they were saying to me, "Beautiful blossom tree. First one that blossoms in the village. Fantastic. What a beautiful blossom tree that you've got." And there was Henneke sweeping the blossom. But she swept the blossom the day before. And as she was sweeping it, it was falling all around her, behind her. So it did not matter how much she swept. And this morning, it's all there. It's still there today. And so, well, why does it matter? Because when we open the door, it blows into the house. Or you tread it into the house. It's beautiful, of course it is. But while you're sweeping, like raking the leaves. Dan's here. He won't mind me saying this. He doesn't like raking the leaves in our garden. It's monotonous, it's meaningless. They fall every year. And every year I rake the leaves. Do you know what I think of? I think of the book of Ecclesiastes. Oh, meaningless. Hey, guess what? When I rake the leaves this year, there'll be more of them, because the trees will have grown. So all the beauty that they give us in the summer, and everyone comes, beautiful trees. Try and get everybody to come and rake the leaves in the autumn. You see, at every level, the philosopher, the preacher, he sees things as meaningless, or he sees them, it's futile. And it's for this reason, friends, that I just say to you now, it's for this reason that often people give up. They quit. They actually quit with life. They can't handle life. It seems so meaningless and futile. Look at the fourth verse for yourselves. What do people gain from all their labours? The point is if we've put so much in, why is it that in comparison with the amount that we put in, that we get so little out? Labours. Now, this might sound ironic, but anyway, some of you are going to start to feel uncomfortable right now. Big style. Take ironing. Look at the men. Take ironing. I'm not joking. Ironing. The same clothes. Look at the ladies here. It was so taken now, I can see. Ironing the same clothes week in and week out. Washing the same clothes week in and week out. Drying them. Washing the dishes. Drying them. All of the labour-intensive stuff of life that we wish wasn't there, but that is there. What does it render after all of the labour of what we put in? That's what he's saying. What do people gain from all of their labours? And it's at this very basic level. There's no point me hiding away from this now. And I've got to get you to face up to this. It's at this very basic level that often people quit. They give up on life. They give up on their families. They give up on their children. They give up on their marriages. They give up on relationships. Because they cannot cope with the meaninglessness of daily life. Get up, go to work. Someone said this to me last week. In fact, this is one of the things that brought me to the Lord as a young man. No doubt about it. Get up, go to work. Eat a bit. Work a bit. Be entertained. Come home. Watch a bit of TV. Eat supper. Go to bed. Get up. Save a bit of money. Go on holiday. Just the same rat of repetitious stuff. Look at verse 8, the word there is wearisome. Labour is wearisome. And the NET Bible says it beautifully. All this monotony is tiresome. No one can bear to describe it. I think it is probably true that many people cannot bear to describe and talk about the monotony of life itself. You'll forgive me if I just come for a moment to the question of drink, but I must do, for everyone's benefit. I'll come to the subject of alcohol later in this series, and I'll touch on it in a bigger way. Why in history have millions of people turned to drink? It's because it numbs the tiresome, meaningless monotony. And so there have been women who wanted to escape the monotony of their life and the pain and the agony of it. And they did it by drink. And I don't condone for one minute the degradation that all of that brought. Because my own grandfather was a drunkard. And my grandmother had to escape him with my mother. So I know something about it from my mother's story. But he was one of countless men and women who were drowning their sorrows of everyday life, of the monotony that they could not face. And I say this to you almost with a passion this morning, for you to be careful and considerate of those who turn to drink and to drugs to dull the monotony of life. Before you come into judgment about them, please. Before you stand over them and condemn them for what has happened. So often it seemed to them and seems today to so many that there is nothing that can get them out of the monotony of life. And I would say to all of you, if people didn't turn to drugs and drink, that's what would surprise me. With a world that is meaningless, that is futile, that has no answers. And it is important at this part of the message to say something about work. What do people gain from all their labours? It's a very important issue to address. After all, you've got to do it for 40 years. The government have just announced, get ready for this, kids, the government have just announced that you're going to have to work until you're 75. That will be the retirement age for the future. So my dad left school when he was 13 and a half, 14, went down a coal mine, and those men were expected, as I said last week, they were expected to work until they were 65. And you can imagine all this tiresome monotony. No one can bear to describe it. And I think that what it was like this, that the teacher, the professor, he looked into ordinary life, just like your life, and he saw the farmer. You can see it in your mind's eye, even though you've never done this. He saw the farmer every day with his hands around the teats of the goat or the cow, milking away. Every day. Every day. He saw the men at the quarry hacking away at stone every day. He saw the men felling trees every day. And he saw the monotony of that life, and he said, it is meaningless. And I've told you before, I tell you again so that you don't forget, my great aunt got on a bus in Barnsley, went to Bradford, went to work at Salt's Mill. She was only 14. She got a room and stayed there, and she worked there until she was 65. And worked in the spinning or the finishing sheds there at Salt's Mill. 12 hours a day. Wouldn't it be good for us all to go together and see it and see the cobblestones that are all rounded off by the millions of feet who just went monotonously day after day. The steps of the feet of millions who worked and worked and worked. The 8th verse says, all this monotony is tiresome, no one can bear to describe it. And it does us well, I think, to stop and think about the burden of labour. The verse says, what do people get from all their effort? Just a thought for all of you to take away from. Where do you think holidays come from? Whose idea was it to have a holiday? My great aunt, when she worked at Salt's Mill, she lived for the holiday, just like many people today. They live only, they exist only for the holiday, because the tiresome, meaningless labour is so great. And what the mill workers and others did is they said this, just listen carefully. You don't think that they'd have given them a day off if they could have got away with it. Of course they wouldn't. They'd have worked them 15 hours a day if they could. It's only that they would have been dying. So they gave them a day off, and they even, Salt introduced the idea of a works holiday, because he knew very well that if he didn't, he wouldn't be able to get more years out of them. It was a pragmatism. But the idea of holiday was to try and save overworked bodies. And you can imagine, in that generation, if there had have been suicides, you could well have understood it. If people had have been driven to the bottle, you could understand it. Of course you could. What did they get from all their labours? My great aunt, what did she get from all of her labours? She got absolutely nothing. The writer says, what do they get from all the labours that they toil at under the sun? And I just leave this thought with you, so that you don't think it's only about the body. Because actually, we all know that the greatest burden is what takes place in the mind. And we wonder, I've had conversations with members of my family in the past, at the mental powers and the dexterity and the strength that men like my dad had to go down a coal mine and work there for 12 hours a day. How do you do that? What mental powers did these people have that they didn't commit suicide? Spend all of their lives in a woolen mill, all of their lives in a coal mine, or in the fields, or at a quarry, or whatever it is, and I'm not going to be unkind, all of our lives at a computer screen. Or me, I'll use myself, at an easel, or wherever it might be. The body is fatigued, yes, but the mind also. And it's not just their generation, it's the generation of today. If this resonates with you, I don't wish to burden you any further, but you must all know that the mental and emotional aspects of labour are very, very keenly felt today as they were then. And so the message resonates and speaks to this very moment. His point is this, is that if all of our endeavours are seen as being under the sun, they'll have an undertone of misery. And I'll just finish this section by quoting something I've quoted. Some of you have heard it before, others have never heard of it, so I'll tell you. Spike Milligan, that very funny man, once said this, money can't buy you happiness, but it buys you a better kind of misery. And there it is. How accurate, how apposite, how to the point was a man like Spike Milligan. Now the fourth verse says generations come and generations go. Let me just say something about this. No matter the advances of time, no matter the advances of our time, this generation will go. Don't you think that 200 years ago, the generation that came along looked back at the last one and said, we are so advanced? Of course they did. But they disappeared. They went. And there will be nothing that can preserve this generation from passing away. On Friday, we had the private funeral of my mother. And at the end, around the grave, when everyone had left, I was standing there with Liam. And he said to me, as we looked into the grave at my mother's coffin, he said, "Our generation next." And he's right. Because that's what the scripture says. And so it will be. The preacher, the philosopher, draws this extraordinary contrast, the aggravation, if you like, of the brevity of our lives. And here we are, the prince of creation, our humanity, and yet inanimate matter just goes on and on and on and on. How do you find meaning in all of that? For the preacher, he means that there's no end to earthly futility, and death is one of the biggest spokespersons of that reality. When you read on, he says, the sun rises and the sun sets, and it's almost as if he suddenly turns his eyes from the earth and he looks upwards. But actually, in fact, he's still viewing everything from under the sun, viewing it from the perspective of the earth. And I'll show you why in a moment, and it becomes quite obvious. But he does gaze upward, as it were, almost for a point of reference. And look at what he sees. He sees what all people have always seen. He sees the created order. And when he looks and he sees the created order, he sees that it's just like man himself. It's exactly like him. The sun just goes on doing what it's always done. It's same repetitious movement. Just goes on, same thing continuously. Like a runner on a circular track. So even when he looks at creation and he goes beyond man, he finds exactly the same thing. Look at the 6th and the 7th verse. The wind also blowing along its circuits, the waters gushing into the seas. They just keep on doing the same thing. And he sees the creation as a type of mirror of ourselves. That's exactly what it is. It's an endless, endless repetition. So even when he looks outside of the earth and he looks beyond as if he might see something different, no, it's all the same story. It's an endless repetition. We used to have a beautiful rose. We planted it. Could see it when we opened our back door. I've never forgotten it. I loved it. It's gone now. It was a climbing rose. I used to love to wait to see. Always came out at the same time every year, of course. But I knew that as soon as its flowers came out, without fail, not once, but every year that we had it, a wind would come. The storm came, sort of late May, June, and it blew all of the roses to pieces. And it was never, ever different. It was always exactly the same. I almost thought, I'm a bit of a meteorologist here at times. I used to see the roses come out. I thought, right, just waiting for this particular wind to come. And of course it did every single year. And I remember bemoaning it. And one could imagine if you were a committed horticulturalist, a devoted man, you would curse the winds. And yet the winds are only doing what they always do. It's just nature, the secularist says. Ah, stop for a minute. The secularist says it's just nature. Where's the meaning in that? And here is the student of the Old Testament. And that, I'd like to think, that is me. That's me. And what do I say? The creation groans. It's groaning. When Adam fell, the whole creation fell with him. And the storms and the lightning and the thunder and the floods and everything else. The perpetual rain. How many of you have said, oh, it's just raining and raining. Why doesn't it stop raining? And why do you think people talk so much about the weather? They're so affected by it. But who can gain any meaning from it? Don't you think the people who were all flooded out just before Christmas would have loved to have gained some meaning to it all? It was all just nature, says the secularist. Yes, viewed from that perspective, that's all it is. And where is the comfort in all of the pain and all of the agony of the disasters? And it's right to go back and say it's meaningless. It is utterly meaningless. The endless round of nature, all so meaningless. You know, when it speaks about the rivers flowing into the sea, I'll tell you what that is. It's so that we can see that the oceans are like us, fed, continuously fed, but never ever full. Never full. Always trying to find something else that will fill us. Because life is meaningless. That's the nature of it. Just like the oceans. We're always on a journey, but we never arrive. Never. Under the sun, life is just like a flowing river, verse 7. Like the wheel of nature, our history is always turning back on itself, always doing the same thing over and over again. And like a river, life is going on and it's wearisome. And I just say this to all of you, if you could listen to this point. What you can do now, when you're young, you can do the same thing when you're older, but you'll be more tired. And you'll get more and more tired. I promise you. That's the law of life. Life is wearisome. The philosopher, the preacher, the teacher, he's not so bothered at this moment about trying to reason with you about God. He's stepping into your shoes if you're a humanist. He's saying, let's have a look at things. I'll tell you about God later. And it's to try, if you like, to make you stop and think about whether you think the paths that you're following are good and right and wholesome. Will they work? Do they have any answers? I'll bring it to a conclusion like this with these words in verse 8, which are, they're wonderful. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. The more that we think that we can hear, the more we'll think that we'll break the monotony. Why do you think that you find it hard to cope with silence? Why do you think that young people can't live without their music? Cannot do it. Possible. Can't deal with the monotony of life. Need to blank out the stuff that's coming into my mind. So let's hear more and more and more. I need to hear more. I need to see more and more. And if I do, then that will deal with the meaninglessness, the dissatisfaction that I have with life. The NET Bible says this: the eye is never satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear ever content with hearing. You'll never be content with what you're listening to now. You'll need something else. You'll never be content with seeing what you see now. You'll want to see something new. And what he is saying is that the meaningless existence that we have that is so empty, the futility of it all, means that I need something new. I need something to alleviate the misery. Give me something new to see and something new to hear. Do you remember the words in Acts 17? You read them. All the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. That's exactly it. In our meaningless existence, we need the constant prattle. We need the constant seeing and hearing of new things. That's why people are easily dissatisfied. We need the gossip and the rest that goes with it. And it shows us that we have never had enough of hearing or of seeing in our dull and dreary and meaningless and utterly meaningless and utterly futile lives. Never enough, never enough. Now, here's the challenge. Have you ever had enough of seeing the beauty of the Lord? You can determine where you're at this morning. Have you ever heard enough of hearing about the loveliness of the God of heaven and of the Lord Jesus Christ? I've had enough of that, thank you very much. But I've not had enough of hearing, of listening, of seeing, of possibility, of all of the new things that can be found under the sun. Ah, that's his whole point. You're living under the sun. You should go beyond the sun and find another place and see what you will discover. Beyond the sun, beyond this world. Because you'll never have enough of hearing, and it will never ultimately satisfy you. And you'll never have enough of seeing. It will never ultimately satisfy you. At the close of this service, you have a chance to talk about spiritual things that you have seen. Have you seen spiritual things? Well, talk about them then. Have you heard spiritual things this morning that would engage you? Well, talk about them. Or you'll talk about all the futile things that we only know about of a life under the sun. The ear never has its fill, the eye never has its fill of things under the sun. So I say to you this morning, leave this world for a short time. Just leave it. For 40 minutes at the end of the meeting, when you're having your coffee, and go beyond a life under the sun and look beyond it. To hearing and seeing and talking about something beyond this futile world. Because if you've not had enough of this world, then that's all you'll talk about. But for me, I prefer the thinking of the philosopher, of the preacher, of the teacher. And he is a great teacher, Koheleth. And he wants to persuade me that there is something better. And I believe that there is. And that which is better is that which is not a life under the sun, but a life in another place, in the knowledge and the presence of God. That's what he will reveal in due course. And if you stick with the series, we'll get to it. At the moment, you might think, well, this is a lot of breaking down and breaking up, and, well, I suppose it is. That's the nature of it. I can't change it. I can't make the Bible what it isn't. Here it is, revealed to us, the book of Ecclesiastes. Wonderful. For me, possibly one of the greatest privileges in life, because I think that this is the way that when we present, ultimately, the gospel like this, the best opportunity ever to show the riches of the glory of the Christian gospel. May God bless his word to our hearing this morning. Amen.